Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
WGN, and a happy Sunday morning to you, everybody out there. 208 on the Sunday morning, and Dave Plyer not in here this morning. It is John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon. Esmeralda, how you doing this morning?
Hello.
Feeling good?
Well, of course.
Yeah, we're going to have a fun three-hour show, and you having problems with the headphones there already? There, Esmeralda? We're off to a roaring start there as we're working on some cords and headphones.
As I plug it in and out, your voice keeps going in and out of my headphones.
Well, that's how
out of one and then the other, so it's like a 3D experience.
Man, off to a great start here this morning. Curtis Koch, our producer. Curtis, how you feeling?
You're feeling pretty good.
Yeah? Feeling alive?
I am feeling more alive. You know what I did before we came here tonight?
What's that?
I got Gene and Jude's.
Gene and Jude's, okay. Yeah, for sure.
So I was producing Blackhawks hockey earlier, so got a little bit of a snack, and I'm all filled up and ready to go.
Blackhawks preseason hockey. Was it their final tune-up, right?
It was, yeah. They were winners 4-1, as Roger was saying, over the Columbus Blue Jackets, and they play the Senators later on this week.
That's great for the opener. Okay, so we're going to have a great show. Obviously, Roger's in the newsroom. He's welcome to chime in at any time, which we usually don't give Roger that free rein, but we're going to go ahead and give it to him today.
He wears a muzzle most of the time.
Normally, we don't like it.
Yeah.
But sometimes we like to start our show with a little bit of a quiz from the headlines. I don't have a name for the segment or anything fun, but feel free to call in, chime in. This is your show, too, 312-981-7200. We'd love for you to join the conversation via text or via talk, too. So, Esmeralda, Curtis, and Roger, I'm going to quiz you from the headlines, and I want someone to call in with the answer, too. You guys ready to play?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. So, this comes out of, I guess I should know where this comes from, the Daily Beast. So, an off-duty Border Patrol agent was ordered to pay $220,000 in restitution on Friday after he accidentally started a 47,000-acre wildfire. So this guy, he's a Border Patrol agent, started this giant wildfire. It was him and his wife that started it. You have to answer how they started the fire or why they started the fire, how the fire was started. It wasn't just lit a match and said they're not arsonists. They were doing something, and it led to a forest fire. 312-981-7200. Any initial fun guesses out of the blue here?
Seance.
No, it was not a seance. That's a good one, though, like lighting some candles around.
Candles, yeah.
That's a good guess. Roger?
I would say that they were sending light signals to aliens in outer space, and somehow they magnified the sun's intensity through the lens.
Sounds like you've done
this
before, Roger.
Day?
Yeah.
This
right.
is in the daytime?
What time?
I don't know. I'll look a little bit more, but... Okay. I would imagine this was during the day. Well, I don't think it matters to the actual result.
I would say bupkis to yours, Roger, only because candles, that'd be a lot of candles.
That would be, to really reflect that
for
light.
For them to see that.
Roger, bad guess, it was wrong. Curtis, you got anything for
see?
Us?
See?
The only thing I can think of that's maybe relatively realistic, more than Roger's at least, is... is some like big bonfire that just kind of got out of control. Maybe he used
they didn't light a match.
Well,
that's a lot of lighter fluid.
I'll just say they weren't arsonists. They were not trying to light a fire that would eventually. No, it was not a bonfire. That's an interesting guess.
You can have a bonfire without actually arsoning things.
Right, a controlled bonfire.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. No, it was not a campfire. It was not a bonfire. So 312.
Were they trying to start a fire of a different nature?
Ooh, maybe the full moon was out that night.
And something got kicked over.
What would you kick over during a...
scented candle, maybe.
No, interesting.
A little, as we call it in certain parts of the country, hooch got spilled over and accidentally lit.
Like an accelerant, what? Like the hooch was there. Like,
yeah.
What year? Did a cow knock it over, too?
No.
Is that what?
Wasn't a miss? They weren't part of the O'Leary family?
It was O'Leary's cow... This is from the Arizona Daily Star, if that helps you out. 37-year-old Dennis Dickey, which goes with Roger's theory, pleaded guilty to the misdemeanor charge of causing a fire without a permit. So obviously there was some sort of spark here. The good news is that no one was injured in this wildfire and that there were no structures
other than the
destroyed.
Animals in
that's
forest.
True. That's true.
Yeah.
So I won't reveal it yet, but 312-981-7200. If you've got any guesses, we actually got someone on the phone right now. We're going to go to, I got to move this computer to get there. Let's go to Roy. Roy, you're on the air. What's your guess here?
Good morning. Control burn, trying to get rid of the underbrush.
Okay, that's an interesting guess. A control burn, they do that in prairies and forests
that's
as well.
That's very practical
That
guess.
Would be practical. That is not the answer, Roy. But thank you for calling. Where are you calling from this morning?
Hickory Hills.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Okay, thanks for the call, Roy. No, it was not a controlled burn. It was anything but. About 800 firefighters worked to stop the fire over a week. This is
goodness.
I know. It destroyed, it cost the state $8.2 million. Okay, so it was him and his wife, and they were together. They were not making whoopee. They did not knock over any hooch. They did not light candles for any sort of thing. I'll give you a clue before we go to a quick commercial break. The clue is baby. Not making one. 312-981-7200. The clue is baby. A husband and a wife caused a fire without a permit that spread over 47,000 acres. I got a lot of confused looks. We're going to go to a quick commercial break. We'll take some calls. Text them in. 312-981-7200. Plenty more on 720 WGN. WGN, Dave Plyer out today. Esmeralda Leon and myself, John Hansen, filling in. Okay, we're talking about an off-duty Border Patrol agent in Arizona ordered to pay over $200,000 after he accidentally started a 47,000-acre wildfire that he and his wife started. How did they start it? Your clue is baby. Let's go to the phone lines. And we say hello to Michelle out in Sycamore. Michelle, how you doing? You're on WGN. Michelle?
Thank you.
Hey, Michelle, how you doing? Sorry, I pressed the wrong button. How you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks. How are you?
Good. What's your guess here? How did they start this fire?
Baby diapers.
Diapers. Okay, because the clue was baby. No, Michelle, that is not the answer.
Oh,
it was not burning diapers or anything like that. Thanks for the phone call, Michelle. Have a great morning, okay?
Okay.
Let's go to Tom. Tom, out in Arizona where this fire was. Tom, do you have a guess?
The agent was firing a rifle, and the rifle had exploding bullets in it, and that started the fire in the Santa Rita Mountain.
That is correct. It was a rifle exploding bullets, but do you know what the bullets were exploding for, the reason for it?
I guess I don't.
Okay, so I'm going to give you half credit there, Tom.
What does that have to do with a baby?
Right, okay, so let's put these things together. Tom, we appreciate the phone call, calling all the way out from Arizona. Okay. So think baby, exploding bullets out of a rifle, a man and his wife.
Uh-huh.
No last guesses, Roger, anything else? I'm going to go ahead and reveal this.
I'm clueless.
And what is that? I don't understand.
Than one.
I'll give you one more clue.
I'm frightened.
We see these videos all over the internet all the time.
What videos are you watching?
You see them, and they're always there. They go wrong. I'll give you one more clue. You're going to get it after this one, though. This is the one you'll get. Your clue is blue, pink.
Oh, those things.
Well, it was a reveal party.
It was a gender.
And there was explosion,
yes.
And it set everything on fire.
It was a gender reveal party that him and his wife were doing, and they had a gun, a rifle, as you heard our phone caller say, with an explosive substance designed to detonate when shot by a high-velocity firearm, a colored powder that would reveal the baby's gender at the party. So if you've never seen these, if it's blue, obviously you know you're having a boy. So the husband and wife don't know. Like, the doctor tells them, and they figure it out some way. You know, they don't know what it is. But he immediately called law enforcement after he started a fire, but 40-mile-an-hour winds that day caused the fire to rapidly spread. Almost 800 firefighters worked to stop the fire over a week. It cost $8.2 million. It was an accident. He called right away. He owned up to it. No injuries, no buildings were reported. So he's got to pay over $200,000.
That's really frightening. I was more worried that it was a real baby. was involved.
Oh, and a rifle?
Yeah.
Yes. I don't think we'd be, I don't think I would have queued up Curtis to play the game show music to
lead him. The fact that you're like, we watch these videos all the time. I'm like, oh my gosh.
I don't, what are your thoughts on the gender reveal party? I don't, I see them all the time.
I kind of don't understand it.
What?
Because who's got to find? I mean, who do you trust to not? I don't know. I'd rather just find. Just get doctor. Can you please just give me the information?
Yeah.
Don't tell my cousin.
There's a meme going out there of like, I had a really great gender reveal party. It's where the doctor talked to us both privately and told us what the gender of our baby was. And
what's the big surprise? It's a 50-50 chance.
You're rolling the dice.
One or the other.
I kind of feel the same way. I'm a little over the whole the fact that it has to be this giant thing.
It has to be a big old party. Why?
Enrique and I just like watching the fails because there's so many gender.
Did you see this one?
No, I didn't see this one.
But they filmed it though.
There's so many that like, let's say, if they're a baseball player, I've seen this a lot, where the baseball player is going to swing and hit a ball, and it's going to do. But there's been so many where the player, I don't know if he thought it was a ball, so he didn't want to swing it instead of a strike, just let it go by, and then it falls to the ground and bursts into the correct color, blue or pink.
Oh, I thought I saw one where someone got smacked in the face.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Because they were in the way.
I've also seen ones where they open boxes, and like inflatable balloons are supposed to pop out. And that it's an assortment of colors, meaning they had no idea what they were. So anyways, it was a gender reveal party gone wrong.
Well, speaking of terrible people. No.
Not our next guest.
Right.
No.
So, you know, with everything going on in the news, you know, I'll say bad people that we deem just they're doing terrible things.
Right.
Awful people. How in the world do you imagine? You can't imagine. Like, why would they do this?
Right. And you wonder how they are the way they are.
Exactly. So I thought we should talk to a doctor who could maybe guide us through this situation, because you just wonder, like, you know, again, how do people either get this way, how
and when you talk about terrible things, you're just talking about just the people we see in our news feeds.
Yes. I'm going to be very general about it.
Okay.
Just things, you know.
In the news, perhaps.
Current events. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people think that. Like, how did this person, how can they do these terrible things? And I'm sure you have people in your life as well.
Right.
That may, to a point, do terrible things. So we brought in Dr. Peter Jonasson. You're in Sydney. So thank you for being with us.
No, it's not that late for me. It's late for you.
I was just going to say, yeah, we're the ones.
Whatever.
We're the ones really struggling. What time is it out there in Sydney?
Yeah, it's approaching 5:30 in the afternoon on Sunday.
Oh, yeah, that's late.
5 o'clock somewhere.
That's late. But, Doctor,
If I wasn't on the phone with you, I'm sure I'd be drinking, right? It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Hey,
have one. It's fun.
We're drinking in studio, so you go ahead.
Oh, well, let me have my brain work well first, and then we'll move on to the alcohol.
Sounds good.
There you go. Dr. Peter Jonasson, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're a senior lecturer in personality and individual differences at the University of Western Sydney. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Great. We just wanted to have you on because I found this article where you you wrote a part of it, but most of your research that you do is on the dark triad, which is negative personalities and that such. And so I feel like I just needed, I'm sure our listeners and myself needed a little bit of a reassurance or some sort of like, why are people like this?
There's some science behind why people are terrible.
Exactly. So just explain a little bit about your research.
In a manner of speaking, and I've been studying, let's call it the dark side of human nature for a decade now. Actually, in truth, I'm a little bit over it. I'm kind of planning on moving on to other things.
To happy people,
right? I'm not a fan of happiness. But I'm on to other questions, I should say. So most of my work has focused on either measurement, our ability to measure and capture individual differences in traits like psychopathy and narcissism and Machiavellianism, all traits that are you know, rampant on the ground, but they're also obviously well represented in these current events that you're alluding to, not wanting to say the specifics about.
Well, you know,
we have enough.
We're just going to be general.
We're just going to be general. There's bad people out there.
Yeah, there's always bad people, but I mean, I think as Obi-Wan said, right? You know, it's a matter of point of view. So you know, it's about a certain point of view, and so. sometimes people's bad behavior looks bad to us,
right.
but it might be advantageous for them, right?
Right?
So from an external source, right, you might say, oh, that woman beating up that man is a bad thing. But if that woman is protecting her child, right, from her position, it's good to be bad now, right? And so there's good, let's call it evolutionary reasons why quote-unquote socially undesirable behaviors can continue in the population. They don't get weeded out, and they're not cultural artifacts or anything like that. It's sometimes being selfish has positive both fitness as an evolutionary fitness, but also interpersonal outcomes. You know, if my goal is to extract immediate resources from a person, from a place, and I'm only going to be there for, let's say, a week, I'm on vacation, well, a mild case of this would be, oh, I'm just not going to tip at any restaurant I go to. This is not, you know, a major crime or anything, but it is a violation of the implicit contract we have with servers.
Right.
Because, well, hey, I'm only here for a week. Why would I be a nice person? It serves me better to just keep, you know, that money to myself and, you know, I'm never going to see this person again. And so when you ratchet this kind of behavior up to larger scale things, when there's more stakes, this is when some of the worst kind of travesties of the world can kind of occur. So just go back in time about, you know, people like Stalin or Pol Pot or Hitler and any of these kinds of people. You take these, let's call them potentially personally adaptive strategies, and when you blow them up to the society level, they start costing the society drastic things, whether it's stability in the society, whether it's war, and a variety of other, you know, social ills. Racism is another one. The dark triad traits, for instance, are found more prevalent in people in the KKK, for example. So as another example of a quote-unquote social ill.
Yeah, I always heard that Pol Pot was a bad tipper, by the way, too. But
terrible.
So I'm sure.
When you talk about this dark triad, the narcissism, the Machiavellianism, and the psychopathy, or psychopathy, are you talking about...
Either way is fine.
So for a truly, you know, whatever, quote-unquote bad person, when we're talking about these traits, is it a confluence of all three of these things? That's what you're talking about when you talk about the dark triad.
Well, there's a few problems here. So we have people tend to be black or white thinkers, right? So there's thought of like you're either a psychopath or you're not, you know? And it's more likely that people are some degree of psychopathy. And just before people get upset, let me explain what that means. It means that you have the occasional ability or the mild ability to, for instance, maybe not feel other people's feelings or to have callous social attitudes or to be impulsive and a variety of things. It's only a pathology when these things are interfering with your life. Now, of course, in politics, often these traits are a virtue because you push through problematic episodes in your life, or you don't give up when you don't win your election or something, and so there's a reward structure surrounding being in this way naughty, in that way, and so the traits go together mostly because they share statistical variance, not necessarily because people who are narcissistic are necessarily psychopathic, but they are a considerable amount of overlap. So narcissists can be exploitive, which is a key feature to psychopathy, and they can be manipulative, which is a key feature of Machiavellianism. And so if you get the dark combination and you're sufficiently high on all those things, plus you're in context that exacerbate those problems, like harsh childhood circumstances or even present circumstances that are, that encourage you to, like you're a gangster or something, encourage you to be manipulative and exploitive, then you have this constellation, this perfect storm, to use the George Clooney movie, that comes together and can create all kinds of bad stuff.
So we have more, we have a few more questions to talk to you about. We have to take a break. Can you hold on the line for us, doctor?
Absolutely not.
Man!
He's got to get that beer, you know? Or his drink,
You go get a beer. We're going to take a break.
I was going to have scotch.
There we go. Pour a little scotch. We're going to take a quick break and then the news here on 720 WGN.
You're listening listening to 720 WGN. Esmeralda Leon, John Hansen in for Dave Plyer this morning. We have Dr. Peter Jonasson on the line, who's speaking to us about the negative side of personality traits, I would say. Not the good stuff.
No, the bad ones.
I mean, but you need both, I would think.
Well, and then we're talking about the scale of badness.
Exactly.
Like, not everyone, there's a lot of gray areas here. But I read this one text, Esmeralda? Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jonasson, thank you so much for joining us. We have a text from someone saying, an Aussie with no accent that drinks scotch, not beer, you're not fitting any of the stereotypes.
Yes, it's because I was born in White Plains, New York, and I grew up in Connecticut.
There you go.
That's what I figured. I was reading through your bio. I thought I'd let you say it instead of instead of me.
Yes, yes. I'm an American, so I just happen to be living in Australia for work.
Yes.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you, you named off some people, Stalin, Pol Pot, that kind of thing. I don't know if you can give me an answer for this, but why do you think people are attracted to those negative personalities of these people?
Or are they just that manipulative?
Right.
Well, a few things. I mean, let's talk about the traits aren't negative. That's a value judgment, right? So they're undesirable traits, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what do you mean by attracted? And interpersonally, sexually, these are persuasive, charming, and sometimes even bullish kind of people who are able mm-hmm. to get their way, mostly because people don't challenge, don't want to speak up, they don't want to say, hey, wait, that sounds like what you're saying is BS, so to speak. Yeah, and so there's often this, they come across as very assured, and people often don't do fact-checking. This is one of those great things about these shows like The Daily Show, where they do all kinds of interesting fact-checking. When politicians say X, they look and say, wait a minute, that doesn't pan out at all. And 3 weeks ago, you said the opposite of that. But they don't... That's in the non, say, romantic space. These are people who can be very exciting in a romantic mm-hmm. space. They're risk takers. They're likely to have status and prestige. They're likely to be well dressed and other things. And so there is some appeal, especially for younger women, to date, you know, bad boys. And while these traits are seen as evil, in milder quantities, they're really just, being brave, being fearless, being ambitious, mm-hmm. and even being assertive, which are all qualities that pay off men both professionally and they pay off men romantically and sexually. And so there's, you know, huge reasons for these to be attractive. But like all traits, they come with, let's call it, collateral damage. And so there are downsides to dating someone who is, say, high on narcissism. They're likely to cheat on you, for example.
Wow.
But there's also similarly downsides to dating someone who is, very high on, let's say, conscientiousness, which is a trait that most people would say is a good trait to have. But if you're really high on conscientiousness, you're a bit of an OCD. You're very particular about how your house is organized. You know, your books are all in order. You know, you have all your records in alphabetical order and all these kinds of mildly anal retentive type behaviors. And this causes problems, too. And so all personality traits are a mixed bag. It's just that because traits like the dark triad tend to have really strong externalities, mm-hmm. as in they cost other people stuff, as opposed to the OCD person who just can't leave their house without checking that they've locked their door about 50 times. Mm-hmm. People high in narcissism often outsource the costs of their bad behavior. And this is why society looks down on these kinds of traits, is because it costs the group. It might be totally beneficial to the individual, but we as a society say, no, that's an intolerable kind of behavior because we don't want to deal with paying your bill.
Mm-hmm. And you have a way, well, you figured out somewhat of a way. I know all of this is very complex and all that, but you figured out the Dirty Dozen scale.
Yeah, so there are challenges to measuring, you know, anything in personality psychology. You have this, mm-hmm. Something that you believe is going on in people's heads, and then you have to find a way to access it without actually taking someone's skull off and looking at their brain.
You
have
can't
to
do that
find
these
a
days,
way
yeah.
To,
no,
right. Yeah, I mean, we're not allowed anymore to do these things. So, so I'd like to keep my job at least for another year or so. So.
Is that when you're tenure tracked?
So, I'm already tenured, but I'm just thinking ahead, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So We had some problems. We had some concerns about older ways of measuring these traits, older ways coming from as far back as the mid-1970s. And so we designed a new scale called the Dirty Dozen. And it's called the Dirty Dozen because there's four items that measure all three of the traits. And it really just captures, in the case of psychopathy, a kind of antisocial cold, callous social attitudes dimension. In the case of Machiavellianism, it captures a manipulativeness, an interpersonal manipulativeness, a willingness to lie. Mm-hmm. In the case of narcissism, it captures a grandiosity. I want to be dominant. I want to be respected. I want to be special type thing. And so it is not without its critics because it's so short that it doesn't maybe capture everything that earlier scales have. But it seems to do relatively a good job. We've just finished a study now in 49 countries with 11,000 people, and the scale holds up in those places, and we've been able to find out some really interesting things about how the traits are related to country-level factors like gender inequality or militarization or the kind of values that a society holds. And it works out the opposite way you'd think it would. It's in societies that are more liberal, there tends to be larger sex differences, and there tends to be higher rates of these traits.
Well, I see things on here like I flatter others.
Right.
Yes, I flatter others. Absolutely. That's one of the narcissism items. That's a Machiavellianism item.
Which seems so nice, though.
When I looked at the 12 of these, and I think that this is how anyone who would take this would say, you know, I think there's a few of them that you'd rate yourself higher on and lower on, and that's going to be natural as people take it. But what you're looking for, obviously, is kind of the confluence of all three of these things kind of coming together. I wanted to go back and ask you really quickly about the when you talk about the difference, the repeat what you were saying earlier, in the more liberal countries, you see a higher spread of, between the sexes. Do you mean in terms of the scores that they get on this, the representation of who has this?
Yes. So we don't diagnose people in any way. We simply get the mean scores that men have, compare them to the mean scores that women have. And this is holding up. This is an effect that's been showing up in other personality inventories as well. That contrary to what the kind of mainstream, what's called social role theory would predict, which is that the reason that there are differences between the sexes is because there are institutional or contextual cultural factors that create that make men. So if a society is more gender imbalanced, let's call it, or lacking in gender equality, that is what creates psychological sex differences. And what the evidence is suggesting is it's just the opposite. It's that when you increase gender equality in societies, you seem to actually open up the door for men and women to kind of engage in their, let's call it, their genetically, you know, derived tendencies. Men tend to be more oriented towards being antisocial already. With fewer restraints put on them, the sex differences seem to grow. And this is in various other traits like extroversion, as well as even in blood pressure of all things. So if you don't like personality, say, well, that's just people making stuff up. You can measure people's personality and you find the same effect, where the sex difference in personality is larger in more liberal places than in more conservative places.
That's very interesting. I see that it would be unexpected, but then you can see why the argument could be made the other way for what you see. It's interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And I looked through this list, and so when you sit people down, when you went through these and you interview these things, do they know? I guess I'm always wondering, you know, when you do these examples, do you mention at the start that you're looking for the dark triad? I mean, like, because I always wondered if people know the motivation behind the questions, does it form the answers to the questions?
No, you don't. You don't have to. You know, when you do these studies, one, you rarely do them face to face. So it's the majority of this kind of research now is done online. And so you put a questionnaire up online, and people go to the website that you've created, and they take it. And in the beginning, you don't, you know, fully tell them, oh, we're looking at the dark triad traits or something like that. But people aren't as deceptive as the cynics would make us believe. People are more interested in rushing through these things than they are in deceiving, and the deception takes a bit of extra cognitive effort, so they just want to get through them. We also, of course, give instructions that say there are no right or wrong answers, et cetera, et cetera. So at the worst, we probably have underestimates of people's darkness, if you will. And so long as we can find the effects we're looking for, we're simply providing conservative estimates of the role of these traits around the world. And it should maybe even be cause for concern because we have underestimates of these effects. And when we're just looking at correlations, it kind of doesn't matter if what the mean score is, so long as there is variance in the score that you can correlate variance in one variable with variance in another. So that doesn't, it won't change the nature of the correlation all that much.
Interesting.
Okay. And I know we have a text. I know they're being a little silly, but the 630 okay. here just is wondering, how does booze affect these strong traits? Because, no, but it's true. You know, a lot of people do say, like, oh, when you've had a few, that's your real
it
personality
comes out
coming
or something.
Out. Yeah. So do you think that has anything?
Well, I mean, I'm fine with the idea of in vino veritas. I mean, I think that's a reasonable thing, partly because what does alcohol do? As a disinhibition, it lowers your ability to modulate your behavior to the context you're in, right? To mm-hmm. If you're getting angry, we are taught, no, you know, don't get all pissed off, don't hurt that person, don't yell, just be polite. But you had a bit to drink, and now you're like, now I'm going to yell at this person. Right? And so it's not necessarily their nature as much as that they're actually an evil person. It's that we all have to deal with negative emotions, and our ability to deal with negative emotions is affected by our physiological states. And so changing your physiological state doesn't necessarily change your who you are as a person. It's a physiological shift more than it is a fundamental change in your or revelation of who you truly are.
It is interesting because, you know, I when I read the text too, I'm like, oh, that's kind mm-hmm. of a silly question. But at the core of a current major event
yeah.
happening with our Supreme yeah. Court Justice yeah, nominee, too. Brett Kavanaugh, and the idea of drinking and maybe some of these traits coming out while drinking. I think we saw a lot of anger in his part coming mm-hmm. out under tension and those sorts of things. And I think a lot of people, you know, it's really easy to read into one TV, congressional
sure.
appearance and
so
read way too much into that. Yeah.
There's a huge appeal of people where they want to diagnose other people. It's very comfortable to label, right? Say, that mm-hmm. person's a psychopath, that person's a narcissist, that person's an extrovert. Because this is back to what I said earlier about the simplistic kind of thinking. We want to put people in boxes. So mm-hmm. if we say he's a psychopath, it allows us to dismiss everything he said, to say we shouldn't hire him and all these other negative things. And so it's a matter of kind of cognitive shortcuts. It's simpler for us to say that, no, the reason he did this is because he was evil, right? This is in social psychology circles, this is called the fundamental attribution error, right? This is assuming that the causal forces behind someone else's behavior is their personality. But when bad stuff happens to you, no, it's the situation. It's the situation. And so we jump the gun on other people and, oh, this person is evil because they're not us. As soon as it's us, it's like, no, it was context. It was,
right.
I was drinking or all these other things, right? Because if we step back and are honest with ourselves, we've all done stupid stuff when we were drunk.
Yes.
And so it's not beyond the pale that people make mistakes when they're drunk, whether it's mistakes that have huge repercussions for the rest of our lives, like drunk driving, for example, if we hit someone drunk driving, or just I kissed someone I shouldn't have.
Right.
It's something as a stupid thing.
We got to take a quick commercial break. I was wondering, we wanted to talk about managing people with the dark
right.
traits. If you can just stay on sure. a little bit longer, we'd love to chat more about that, okay?
See you soon.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
Exactly. Plenty more with Dr. Jonathan coming up after the break here on 720 WGN.
WGN, Esmeralda Leon, John Hansen, in for Dave Plyer. And on the line, we have Dr. Peter Jonasson talking to us about dark personalities, specifically the dark triad traits.
And that sounds so evil and
right?
spooky, but it was interesting, Doctor, is that we often, again, as we say, we put negative attributions to these sorts of things. I find it interesting that you really try and take that out of the study, that it's almost like an objective look at it, which is obviously what a researcher should do. But I guess my question is when someone, like you mentioned, Pol Pot, Stalin, mm-hmm. when these people come to power, though, isn't it up to the people to start watching out for other people like this and starting to make sure that those people don't get into power, or is that just unavoidable?
Well, I think there are cultural contexts that make people like, you know, these dictators rise. But we have, you know, mild examples of these all over the world. I mean, you know, there's lots of actors and singers that could easily be considered high on narcissism. I mean, you know, Kanye West, just as my favorite example. Yeah. I mean, there can be no question, right? But his narcissism isn't problematic. And if we were to go around policing everybody's narcissism, we would lose the upsides of those narcissism. So it would be like taking a drug to eliminate the heavy swings in someone's mood. Most people who take these drugs for things like cyclothymia, where there's lots of ups and downs in their mood states, what they report is that they feel just blah all the time. It eliminates the down, sure, so they're not depressed and they're not trying to kill themselves, but they also feel nothing particularly interesting. They feel no passion for anything in the world. And you'd get the same effect if we as a society started policing these kinds of traits. We would lose all the upsides. Also, we would get ourselves into a quasi-eugenics realm. Ooh, where we've decided as a society that these traits, which are genetic, which are in certain people, that we're going to say those people must be whatever, euthanized, sanctioned, any of these kinds of things. And so that we can't know as people living 80, 90 years, the potential advantages in a grand evolutionary scheme of why narcissism would be a good thing to have, why psychopathy would be a good thing to have. I mean, if you're a special forces soldier, it's probably good that you have a psychopathy in you.
Interesting.
Your ability to turn off your emotions when fighting enemies is a trait that is rare but is useful, because there's sometimes you have to kill that cute little bunny to survive.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, this sounds like the start of a movie, by the way, the eugenics aspect of it. Like
the dog triad.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, so
we have conversations about this in personality psychology conferences, and you get in psychology, and social psychology in particular, is a very heavy left kind of oriented philosophical bias, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And they want to control and contort and say these aren't the kinds of traits that we think are acceptable in people.
Yeah.
And so they want to essentially, you know, how do we change people's psychopathy? This is a common thing. I have a PhD student working on something like this now, and we don't actually think you can make someone who is high on psychopathy no longer high on psychopathy. What we think you can do, and then there's at least some evidence to say that we're on the right track here, is that you can essentially neuter the psychopath. And I don't mean neuter like actually remove
right.
their testicles.
Right.
What I mean is neuter in a metaphoric sense. And so if you can undermine the tendency for them to impose costs on the world while not undermining their sense of, you know, what they need psychologically, because these people have psychological needs mm-hmm. that need to be met also. And so if you can do both simultaneously, what you get is neutered psychopaths. And so we have some evidence that says that if you make people high on the dark triad, we haven't done that yet, but look at pictures of babies. There seems to be something of a suppression of their tendency to be aggressive.
Interesting.
Right? So we haven't changed the nature of the beast, so to speak, right? All we've done is change the beast's behavior.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm like, for regular Joes, you see this, and maybe you see this list, like you lack remorse and mean and insensitive, and maybe you know somebody, and you're just like, what are you supposed to do then? How do you deal
I'm
with
sure
that?
I'm sure we do.
Is it just a matter of bringing a bunch of puppies to them, or what?
Right, just pictures of babies every time you see friend Joe?
Well, it may be one of the tricks, yeah. I mean, there may be other things that are coming out down the pipeline. So VR has the potential to potentially reshape people's kind of experiences that exacerbate these problems, right? So I have gone on the record repeatedly, and it sometimes hasn't gone very well, but I'm not afraid to say, look, I am a little narcissistic. Yeah. I'm willing to admit that, not just for my science, but I think it's a reasonable thing to say. But if you don't have the right circumstances around you, especially when you're a kid, that trait of, say, narcissism can dovetail in a whole slew of bad ways. So it's the trait alone is not necessarily going to mean that you're going to do all these horrible things. Mm-hmm. It's the trait plus something else, or maybe even lacking something else. And so psychopathy is a good example. Evidence by my own hand, at least, suggests that father absence is problematic for psychopathy. And so why would that matter? Why would a lack of father in a child's life matter? Well, we see this in elephants. When poachers have killed the big bull elephants, says they want the big tusks. Right. The juvenile male elephants are just like basically teenagers running rampant and being what you would describe as essentially a psychopath. They're being bullies. They're being obnoxious because there's no bull male around to like essentially give them a smack with their trunk and say, act right, right, you little punk. Not that they, of course, say anything literal, but there is a presence of maleness that seems to have a very unique effect. Now, contrast that to narcissism. Narcissism seems to be somewhat more tied to, I don't want to call it helicopter moms, but an overly doting mother and an overly, you know, oh, you're amazing, you're this, you're that, this kind of spoiling kind of mothering approach. And there's no, I'm not putting any fault on the moms, I'm not putting fault right on the dads. These are statistical trends, and our lives are our lives, and they go the way they go.
Yeah.
It's just, this seems to be one of the patterns, is that if you build your kid up to think that they're special, regardless of feedback from the world that tells them they're not special, then bad stuff happens.
Right? Interesting.
So we have a politician who's in charge now, of course, in the States, who is probably one of these people, and that he's unlikely to have experienced any repercussions for his bad behavior and everything. Oh, you're great. You just listen to how he talks. His self-delusion of how wonderful he is, right? It suggests that he's either never heard negative feedback, or he's just never listened to it ever in his life.
That's all I ever got from my mom. So this is perfect.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah, and so we live in a world now. We live in a generation where no one is allowed to be criticized. Everyone gets participation trophies, self-esteem, self-esteem, self-esteem. And what we know from 20 years of work is that all that talk in the 60s and the 70s, the hippie movement, essentially, about self-esteem is the root cause of a lot of the problems that we find ourselves in today, because self-esteem became more important than competence.
Wow.
Love yourself.
Wow.
It doesn't matter. All that stuff doesn't matter, right? So if you just have self-esteem, we actually call that something else. That's called narcissism, right? Loving yourself regardless of feedback.
Yeah. Hey, Doctor.
Right? Loving yourself regardless of feedback is narcissism. It's a delusion of I am wonderful. Now, liking yourself is good. Being depressed, don't do any of it. But if it is well beyond reasonable, you know, if I'm just a professor, I'm 5'8", right? Oh, I'm going to get Mila Kunis. I'm going to get Scarlett Johansson. I'm going to marry them. They're going to date me. Like, get out of town.
Well, that, right? You need a few more drinks of scotch for that, exactly.
Right?
Hey, Doctor, I hate to cut you off, though.
No, they need a few drinks of scotch.
Well, that's a whole other discussion. Well, Doctor, we appreciate your time. We do have to run to our news break now. We really appreciate
this. This is a lot to unpack.
Yeah, I know. We could have gone for another 2 hours. For more information, you can go to www.peterjonason.com. That's JONASON. Doctor, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much.
That was a fascinating discussion.
Goodness gracious. Like, all of it's like, yep. No, that makes sense.
Speaking of participation awards, I've got a really interesting story after the news that I want to talk about, okay?
Got it.
Here are the sounds that matter. The top 5 at 5 from the Rogue Con show with Anna DeVellantes, weekday afternoons on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN radio on TuneIn. It is 3:03. We head to the Dark Triad. That's what he calls the newsroom with Roger Badish. WGN, and a pleasant Sunday morning to you. It's 3:10, and Dave Plyer is out this week. In his stead is myself, John Hansen, and Esmeralda Leon. Curtis Koch is producing, and Roger Badish in the newsroom. Roger, you're a former teacher, right?
Yes, I am.
So I'm interested to hear your perspective on this next story. This kind of stems off briefly what the doctor was talking about before we went to the news about how we are a participation trophy culture, I guess, these days.
Mm-hmm. Bringing up kids people when they don't really deserve it.
And, you know, I got to say that I am blessed that I think I grew up with consequences still, but mm-hmm. a lot of you can do anything attitude as well. Like, my parents were very pro, you know, go for it, give it a shot, but we didn't get participation. I mean, it was kind of like a mix. Probably my parents were both hippies of the 60s, but mm-hmm. still had enough consequences themselves growing up, and that luckily I'm still of that generation where, yeah, if you lost the baseball game, you lost the baseball right. game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not to cast, like, I don't have any issue with the participation trophy thing. I think that it's interesting that psychologists are looking at the long-term effects of it, even if it is going to elephants to figure out exactly what's going on. But I'm not trying to stoke generational fires with this story, but I'd love to get everyone's input. And I have a feeling I know how callers and texters are going to feel. 312-981-7200. Okay. So a recent email, this comes from the Northwest Indiana Times, a recent email from the principal at Portage High School reminding teachers not to grade any test or quiz below 50% is causing enough concern that is reportedly being taken up next week by the teachers union. Mm-hmm. The superintendent's defending the practice in being in the best interest of the students. So even if you don't turn something in, or even if you get a 3 out of 10 on a quiz, which would be a 30%, mm-hmm. The lowest you could get would be a 50%. Mm-hmm. So they say that leading educational experts, this is the superintendent, support the philosophy that the impact of assigning zeros portrays a mathematically inaccurate picture. It's devastating to student motivation. So if you get a 0 or a 10 or a 20, what they're essentially saying is a score that low kills a student's motivation, because it's then that much harder for them to make up that grade and bring an F, mm-hmm. the overall mm-hmm. grade, from an F to a D. You know, like a big fat mm-hmm. zero is really bad and really hard to get over.
Sure.
But the question is, if someone doesn't turn anything in, mm-hmm. or if they get a 0 out of 10 on a quiz because they didn't study, they didn't read the book, is it giving them too much reward to just give them a 50? It's out of 100. Mm-hmm. Is that fair? What happens if one student, you know, really did study, they just didn't do as well, they got a 5 out of 10 because they studied the quiz, you know, whatever. They get the same grade then. So that there's got to be some fairness to this. So is Roger, as a mm-hmm. former teacher, mm-hmm. would you give a 0 if they didn't turn anything in?
How much time you got left on your show?
But honestly,
no, I'm serious. I'm deadly serious. This is not new.
The 50%
is not new.
Well, okay.
We were told this 5 years ago.
To give a 50?
Yes.
And what did you think about it?
I thought it was disgusting.
Really?
Seriously. For those two reasons. You just put out those two reasons. There's two types of students who get bad grades. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm generalizing like crazy, but we're short on time.
Right.
You have the student that has come to school already with issues that have nothing to do with the teacher, with the coursework, or with school.
Right.
They could be brilliant, or they could just not really be getting the information. But the reasons why they're one or the other has nothing to do with school.
Right. They're
there
coming in with predetermined,
going on in their
yes.
life. Right.
Right.
So the other type of student is the one who struggles. I struggled through school.
Right.
I was smart enough, but I didn't do tests well. I'm not a good test taker. And I just didn't focus on those things that I needed to focus on
okay.
in order to get better grades.
So you're talking about there's two types of students.
Right.
A failing or struggling student.
Right. And so I struggled all through school, which is weird because then I suddenly became a teacher.
Right.
But that aside, so you've got those two types of students. For the type of student that is struggling, they're going to keep trying. And if a teacher is worth their salt, if a school is worth their salt, the teachers will work together for those students to help them succeed to the best of their ability. Those are the students you don't mind giving extra work to.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's a course syllabus. Here is what you need to do and learn between now, the beginning of school year, and the end of the school year in order to keep you at grade level.
So is that
if you do not do this stuff,
okay,
I cannot move you on to the next grade level.
Right.
So for the student who comes in who doesn't care for whatever reason, and most of those reasons are from outside of the school itself, then I'm not going to encourage your...
your lack of motivation, your lack of whatever.
But again, the lack of motivation is based on something outside of school.
Right, so you're saying that if you give them a 0 or a 50, it doesn't matter. They're not going to...
It doesn't matter, and they will come in at the end of school, having already missed more than their allowed days of school, which is another matter.
That's a whole other thing.
They will come and say, what extra work can I do to get a passing grade? What's the least amount I can do after I haven't done anything all year long? Right. And my words to them are, as I call their parents for the 10,000th time, because that has to be part of the equation also all year long, my explanation to them is there's nothing you can do because you have not met the minimum requirements to even be considered for extra credit work.
All right, so you're saying that...
And my students knew this when they walked in my classroom.
If you rewarded them with a 50 for not turning anything in, that does not really provide the impetus for motivation. And at the end of the day, then they can manipulate the system to do the very bare minimum just to pass on to the next grade level.
See, here's the thinking behind that. In grading stuff... You know what the usual grades are, right?
Yes.
A, B, C, D, F. Well, and a D is 60%.
Right.
So if you give a student 50%, it's still a what letter
grade?
An F. So a 0 or a 50. This was the rationale we were told 5-6 years ago. It's still an F. That student is still doing F work.
Right.
Okay.
And that's what Esmeralda and I were talking about.
Exactly. So, but if a student has 50%, and they know this going into the beginning of the school year, they know they can do the bare minimum, if not less,
just
and
to
still get away with getting a 60%.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I see it both ways. I do see that, and you're right.
And I don't mean to yell, and I apologize.
No, and we are generalizing about students and their backgrounds.
Because you know how strongly I feel about
that. No, I know.
Okay.
But I do see a scenario in which you do have someone in the latter group of the two you mentioned who needs a little extra help, who maybe has some other issues, but is motivated to try. Man, a 0 right off the bat for whatever reason, you know.
And trust me, a 0 on a test in a high school class, that's not the first 0 that student has gotten.
I understand, but you can understand why then they just are like, well, I have no way to get out of this hole.
If it comes down to the teacher, and if a teacher sets the tone and sets the requirements at the beginning of the school year in their class, which is what every teacher is supposed to do.
Right.
It's not what I would do. It's every teacher is supposed to do that. You're supposed to give a syllabus at the beginning of the school year, even for a grade school. Here is what we are going to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I sent the syllabus home with the students and to have the parent sign the agreement letter.
Yeah.
And then called the parent after I got the letter back saying, did you sign this?
Well, you know all that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is it does.
Hey, Roger, we got a quick phone call.
I'm sorry.
No, you're good. That's why I'm glad you're here. You're the only teacher here on the mic. So,
right. We're only students.
Let's go to Robert in Oakbrook. You got some personal experience with this, Robert?
Yeah, Roger is absolutely correct in what he is saying.
Yeah, he doesn't hear that very often. So he's really happy.
I have 5 teachers in my family. Okay, my mom was a school teacher. And when I went through school, I was a special ed kid. Okay? And you know, in special ed, I'm going back into the 70s now. They always, like, pampered you. But I had 3 teachers that would tell me, Robert, you're getting a D. He goes, you got to do this, this, and this. And you can bring your grade up. And when I did this, this, and this, and I brought my grade up to a C+ or a B, they would say, good job.
Yes.
Now, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to figure out what you're doing wrong to apply it to achieve a better grade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, it took me 6 years to get through college, but I got through
college. Hey, you got through. Who cares?
See, but then it's but you're. I know these might be just details, but you said you know you were getting D's, but what if you're just getting flat zeros? Where how are you going to dig yourself out of that hole?
Well, you can't, and that's the whole purpose. Now, I've owned 12 companies since I've been out of school.
Oh.
All right? Six of them went into the toilet. All right? If I did not learn those lessons in school, that you look at what you did wrong, you apply it to your next business, okay? Now I have four corporations that are doing very well. And I wouldn't be at this position in my life, and I'm 60 years old, and I'm doing really good, unless I had those lessons where it counts, which is whether it's in grammar school or high school, and all this win-win-win stuff.
Yeah.
People don't realize that they're actually hurting society at all.
No, Robert, you make a great point, and I got to let you go because we're going to take a commercial break, but we always appreciate your listening and chiming in, Robert, out on Oakbrook. And there's no doubt. The one thing I will say about this, and Roger, this is going to set you off, I know, or at least send you on a – not set you off, but I know you have opinion. I think part of this stems from the – undue pressures that our state, local, and national governments are placing on testing scores and on graduation rates.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which are, graduation rates are hugely important. But I think a lot of this is a school district and maybe other school districts, they're trying to throw all this, oh, it's for motivation. I just think they want more kids out the door because that's the rates that the superintendent and the principal have to meet. Otherwise, they're going to lose their job.
Exactly.
And I think that that is doing it. And look,
it's a complete disservice.
And this is really hard, though, because we do want our schools doing well. There's got to be some barometric, rating, not barometric, but, you know, there's got to be some measurements for what is good performance.
Right.
But at the end of the day, what should be the most important thing is the individual relationships between teachers who we have trained to do with this job and the students individually. And it should be up to each teacher in their own classrooms how they want to administer that. That's at least the school environment.
You know, when you got 30 kids in one.
I know. I know it's a lot. And that's, I mean, we could go, our teachers should be making six figures when the moment they start most of their jobs and all this stuff. And yes, how are we going to pay for it? There's so many questions. Right. This is very
complicated. One last thing I want to add to that. And it has to do with the climate in a school. If you have the situation where students know they can do the bare minimum, that not much is expected of them, and they can still waste a whole school year and still get by, that then affects the classroom management of the teacher. And if the kids know they can get away with, I hate to say this, but get away with murder during the entire school year and not do anything, then the teacher can't control that classroom.
Yeah, you need leverage.
Right, and you have in every class, a lot of people don't understand this, but in every class you have a very wide range of capabilities of students. You have students who are at least three grade levels behind where they should be, and you have students who are three grade levels ahead of where they should be.
All in one class.
All in one class, and you don't have enough chairs for all of them.
Yeah. Roger, I commend you for your teaching efforts. My mom was a teacher for 30 years in public schools doing art. And to every teacher listening out there, you know, our hearts and minds are with you. You have extraordinarily difficult jobs. And it's such a complicated matter. And same for the principals and superintendents. I know a lot of them, they're
pressure's
well
on them too,
pressure's
because
on them.
The state That's education wish, department, yeah. the funding. You go back and if you want schools to get more funding to build new science labs
that
haven't been updated in 50 years, to get new textbooks that are 70 years old, and you go to the public and you say, we need more money, and the public says, well, you're not educating our students. They're failing. They're not going to college. My kid doesn't like school. Right. Well, you're not going to get the money. It's a vicious circle.
It really is, and we're not going to be able to solve it before 5 a.m.
Darn.
Maybe if we had till 6, we could do it.
Maybe 5 minutes after. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll have some news and some more interesting topics, including, do you make the bed every day? 312-981-7200. Curtis is already saying no. I don't know. I'm curious to see about Esmeralda. I'm guessing no as well there, too. We'll find out here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN and a happy Sunday morning to you. It is 3:28, almost 3:29, and Dave Plyer's out today, and Esmeralda Leon and myself filling in about halfway through. Esmeralda, what was your event that you were doing tonight, by the way?
I was hosting You, Me, Them, Everybody Live. It's a podcast we do. Essentially, it's a talk show. It's myself and my co-host, Brandon Weatherby. We did it at a bar called The Hungry Brain.
Mm.
It was really good time. We had comedian Bobby Buds. We had food and drink Chicago Tribune editor Joe Hernandez.
Oh, yeah. Joe's great.
So it was a good time.
Where can people find the podcast?
You can go to youmethemeverybody.com.
Youmethemeverybody.com. That's really cool stuff. How often do you guys do those?
Whenever he's in town. Because he lives in D.C. Yeah. He actually does them regularly there. But, you know, he's originally from Chicago, but he moved. So every once in a while when he comes in, we do a show.
Cool stuff. Hey, do you make the bed every day, Esmeralda?
No.
Curtis, do you make the bed every day?
No, I do not.
Roger Battis, do you make the bed every day?
It's a recliner, but yes.
Oh, that's right. You make it. Yeah.
And, do you pull the sheets over it and do the whole?
It's very simple. I have a blanket when it's cold. But I have, you can call it a sheet that I put over it when I go to sleep at night.
Well, see, there you go.
There, you
and
make
I
it
do.
A,
I tell you, I mean,
move
after
it into the upright position.
Yeah. How do you think I get out? I'm going to need one of those power ones pretty soon where it like forces you up out of the chair. Wow.
Just get someone behind you. You pay someone to just push you off.
Oh, I've got one of those wall hugger chairs, so it's right up against the wall.
Right, right.
You can go back on it all the way, and it doesn't hit the wall. You can get it really close.
There you go. Yeah. I don't make the bed every day, and apparently myself, Curtis, and Esmeralda are not having as much sex as we could be.
Clearly.
That's a tease. Roger, the only one who does make the bed, however, apparently. Anyways, we're going to talk about why might be a correlation between
in that rubber room that he has.
Why there might be a correlation of making the bed and making whoopee. But first, it is news time, 3:31, over to Roger Battis. WGN, happy Sunday morning, 3:37 on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer out, John Hansen here, and Esmeralda Leon as well. And we were talking before the break, we teed up this article, Esmeralda, that I think you actually sent over a couple weeks ago when we were on last time. Mm-hmm. We didn't quite get to it, though, about making the bed and the effects that that might have on you, your life, and what you do. And Esmeralda, I mean, like, I clean my whole place every Friday afternoon.
Wow.
So I work the morning shift.
Good for you.
Yeah, so I work a morning shift. Well, I feel like that's the way to start my weekend. I usually have a couple drinks while I do it, turn on some music, including the song that Curtis bumped us in with, and I just kind of dance around, clean, and then, I scrub the toilets, do the sinks and everything, just to keep a general upkeep of it. Last week, we went to Michigan for a reunion party for Enrique, so I missed a week, so this week was a little bit more involved.
It's a pigsty.
But it is really the only time I do fully make the bed, is when I clean the whole apartment.
Yeah.
I do not do it every day. And I would imagine most people are like that. I'm curious if anyone is out there who actually gets up, especially if you have a gig you got to go to, and makes the bed. 312-981-7200, talk or text. But I will say, when the bed is made, it does feel better.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It looks neater.
And it doesn't take much time.
Yeah.
So why don't we do it every day?
I don't. Well, one, I don't care. No
right.
one's looking. No
right.
one's looking at my bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
It is at least mine is a pig. There's clothes everywhere. Why would I make
regardless of whether the bed is made or not.
Right? So it's just going to be a very neat bed in the tornado that is the bedroom.
Do you think if you made your bed, that would motivate you to keep the rest? Okay. I'm
sounds
not judging
like she's
you.
Already had this discussion with herself.
Yeah. I'm just like, no, probably not.
The only people that I know of that make the bed every day are a lot of former military people, because it's just kind of ingrained in who they are, and they continue doing that. But apparently we should all be doing it. Making the bed gives the illusion of put-togetherness. This comes from wellandgood.com. Solid proof, quote-unquote, that you're living your best life. Now, a new study is speaking to the differences between bed makers and non-bed makers. So, in a recent survey conducted by OnePoll, 2,000 Americans divulged their personal habits across a wide range of things. It found that bed makers are adventurous, they're confident, they're sociable, and they're high maintenance, which that doesn't surprise me, a high maintenance person.
Right. I don't get the adventurous. They're making their beds.
I don't think that's the qualifying factor of what they do that makes them adventurous. I think it's, you know, that's who they are. Confident, that kind of makes sense. But
yeah.
I feel like I'm adventurous, confident, sociable, and a little high maintenance, and I only make it once a week. Non-bed makers are shy, moody, curious, and sarcastic. That's interesting. It goes on to say that bed makers are bright-eyed morning people who have sex just a little bit more than non-bed makers. And then it puts in parentheticals, three times a week versus two. That's not a little difference. That's one more whole time a week.
Yeah, and
that's
it's not,
pretty good. I
it's
take
not two
that.
And a half.
Well, wait a minute. That really doesn't sound like a lot. So what's the incentive?
Whoa.
I mean, if there
Roger,
was like...
Roger, it's one extra unit.
Roger, are you seeing that as more work?
Possibly.
Three times.
I'm semi-retired.
That's crazy.
I'm semi-retired.
And
my wife and I will be married 43 years come February.
You're semi-retired. They got a pill for that now. But anyways, so three times versus two. All right. So apparently they also get better quality sleep. They have more time during the day to get their stuff done because they wake up 16 minutes earlier. So if you're someone that has that mindset that you're going to make your bed every day, apparently you're planning for it by giving yourself some more time.
Wait, that doesn't sound right. If you know you're going to make your bed and you're supposedly sleeping more soundly, I think that if you're going to be making your bed when you wake up, then you're probably not sleeping well because you're worried about getting up in time to be able to make your bed.
I think what they're saying is if you're a bed maker first thing in the morning, you're part of this regimented lifestyle where you're anticipating what the day is going to be. You've already got it planned out. It starts with a nice, freshly made bed that you make.
These aren't nervous people.
Yeah, they're not. This is just part of their lifestyle. That maybe someone like us who doesn't make their bed, we live much more in this creative, you know, hit the snooze if you can sort of thing. And if I didn't have to wake up at 3 every morning, I would not do that. But that the idea that they wake up 16 minutes earlier, that's not 16 minutes to make the bed. That's just part of who they are.
I will say that when I get into my bed, it is a big old mess because it's all undone. And then for some reason, the sheets always get kicked off.
Yeah.
Everything is on the ground or somewhere. And then you have to fix it just before you get into bed because I like a neat bed. To get into it,
then
I won't make it.
Maybe you should start making your bed. Why not?
No.
See, I feel the same way. I hate when I get in bed and the comforter somehow from the night before has now turned 90 degrees.
Yeah.
And now the short end is over my feet.
I tuck my sheets in when I make it.
Right.
And then it gets all undone and then I just never tuck them back in.
I guess in theory, if I just waited till the next night, it would have rotated 180 degrees and then it's back where it should be.
See?
And then slowly but surely every other night, it just is
off.
And
that is the thought process of not making your bed.
I don't know. 312-981-7200. Do you make your bed every day? The text from the 727 says, yes, it is calming, which I agree with. There's something about when you look in the room, because I'm good about not having a clothes tornado. I have my laundry basket. I hang up the clothes. But even if the floor is clear and the bed is unmade, it's not anxiety, but it is something like something is amiss and you know it.
Right.
708 says, I make the bed every day. Make sure there are no dishes in the sink before I go to bed.
Please, I'd be up all night.
When I was little, we didn't have a bedroom door, so mom always made us. So, yeah, I'd see that's something that gets regimented in you.
Yeah, I guess I'm a slow cleaner because I can't clean everything before I go to bed. I usually just go, whatever, that's dirty, I'll do it tomorrow.
Right. Curtis, and so you don't make your bed. Does it give you any anxiety, Curtis? We can't hear you right now. Your mic is not. Curtis, we can't hear you on your microphone.
I love that he
kept on going.
We're looking at him and he's not.
You know what it is? It's this dang cue button.
Yeah.
I guess
that's okay.
Anyways, I don't make my bed. It's a bed. I sleep in it. I just want to get as much sleep as I can.
Right.
Wake up the next morning.
But when you look at it, it doesn't bother you like when you're moving around the house and stuff.
You're
like
not
that.
Looking at it, right?
I just close my door and act like it's not.
It's
there.
Behind you. And also, when you are about to get in, it's already undone and comfy, and lived in.
Lived. It's
so
a.
So then you slide on in and go, bedtime.
It's already got the.
Yeah.
I also like just my room generally cool at night when I fall asleep.
Okay.
And so when I get into bed, I like my bed kind of cool as well. So I'll have my fan on before I go to bed.
So fanning the sheets and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So then it's not, since it doesn't have to be making it, since it'll just cool off the whole day. And then.
So you want an.
How hot is your bed?
What sort of. So you want an exposed sheet.
Yeah, like you just pull the blanket back.
Right.
And then when you go into bed and you pull the covers over, I just kind of cool off and just relax. Okay. And then I go to bed. Go to sleep.
All right. Yeah, it's interesting. If it says that if bed making gives you a karmatic boost, just imagine what turning your room into a self-care sanctuary can do. There's a whole other article about that stuff. Anyways, if you make your bed great, if you don't, that's okay too. I don't know. I just do feel that my life is more put together the moment after that apartment and that bedroom and the bed is made and it's all clean. I don't know, maybe just me.
Yeah, but it isn't.
Yeah, but it feels like it is.
Only once a week.
I know.
What are those other days?
I slept before I came here. It's unmade right now, and now that's giving me anxiety.
How dare you?
312-91-7200. Do you make your bed, or should we talk about something else here on 720 WGN? I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black. 720 WGN, John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon, filling in for Dave Plyer until 5 a.m. here on this Sunday morning.
By the way, painting black, that way you don't see all the stains.
Painting what black? What?
Anything.
In general?
The song. Is it painted
black? Oh, I wasn't paying attention. I'm sorry. We're talking about making the bed. So the article also goes on to say that the idea of making the bed is also, it sets off a chain of events. Like a positive life chain. It's not just about that one thing, obviously. Mm-hmm. That one thing leads to other things, like adventures.
Adventures? What?
That's how you make your bed. That's how you become an adventurous person, is you start with a clean room and go from there.
I guess. Okay, Mom.
Let's go out.
See, that sounds like something a mom would say.
Right. It'll lead to adventures.
It'll lead to adventures, son. Mm-hmm.
Let's go out to Brian in Harwood Heights. Brian, turn your radio down, and do you make the bed?
Are you at a bar right now, Brian? What's that?
I hear noises in the background. Are you with people, or is that the radio?
Hold on one second, John, okay?
Yeah, turn that radio down.
Okay, you don't have to yell
turn
at them.
The radio. It's great to hear from Esmeralda.
Isn't it? I am really, really happy
to hear her voice, and I want her to be on WGN. That's number one. Number two, yes, I do make my bed, and not every day.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got an old lady, so I mean, she can make up the bed.
Oh, so the other time she doesn't?
We have fun undressing the bed. So,
Wait, whoa. Okay, so they.
Well, I mean, you know what I'm saying.
I do. So you.
Yeah.
So the bed is, whether it's you or the lady, the bed is made every day.
Pretty much so, yes, sir. I mean, I did it when I was in the Navy during Vietnam and stuff. You had to make your bunk up before. Otherwise, you got a written notice. And if you had three of them, you'd have to go to what they call a captain's mess.
What happened there?
That's where you get punished.
What would happen?
Yeah, what'd they do?
Well, I mean, they could give you, limited shore duty, you know, from going ashore. You have to stay out. They could give you more work hours in terms of, you know, working on the boat while you're in port, and they'd be crazy jobs that you would never want to do. It's indescribable.
That's what they tell you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. They have a lot of options. Let's just put it that way. When the officers tell you, and you're on shipboard and stuff like that, you don't make your bunk up, you got a big, big problem.
So you think that's something you brought home with you? Because that's what I guessed early was that people that didn't make the bed, or that people that do make the bed often are often military people.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, you're probably right about that because it really gets ingrained in you because, like, when I was in boot camp out in San Diego in the U.S. Navy back in Vietnam era,
You got in trouble. Could not get
out of the barracks until you had your bunk made. You had to be able to bounce a quarter on it.
What do you mean?
Well, you can take a quarter out of your pocket if you had one.
Yeah.
All right? And then you flip it up in the air like a coin toss at a football game, and you bounce it on your bunk. If it bounced up, you pass.
Okay? All right.
That's called tightening the rack. And
see, I would just put some sort of rubber sheet underneath, and then it would bounce.
Yeah, I'd put a trampoline there or something underneath the sheet.
So to speak.
What time did you wake up in the morning out there?
In San Diego, usually reveille would be 5 in the morning.
Ooh, that's
so late.
And then
you go until 9 o'clock that night after you're doing marching, swinging rifles. You learn how to march cadence in order.
Yeah.
You go sideways, angle-wise, all that, and boom, boom, boom. And you're swinging rifles with bayonets on them. That's when I was in. And, but that's, some of the stuff we learned. And so now I do it. The only time I don't do it, John, or Esmeralda, I got to get you in here, girl, is when, I'm home. If I'm home, the bed can stay unmade.
Okay. Oh, if you're still in the room, if you leave home, that's when it's got to be done.
That's correct. Because, I want to have fun undoing it by that point.
Oh,
goodness gracious.
See, that's what I'm talking about. He makes the bed.
Couple of bottles of wine, I'm ready to go.
Bo, Brian.
You know what I mean? Hello. But.
Well, Brian, we appreciate your phone call. We got to let you go, but thanks for calling in. Thanks for the
chatting with both you folks. Have a great, great night. Hello, Roger. Baddish. I love you, too.
Oh, Roger, he's doing a quick coffee break. He heard you, though. Thank you very much, Brian. Oh, what a sweet...
You know what I'm also thinking?
What's that?
How many sheets are on your bed?
I have the comforter, which doesn't count. Then I have the fitted sheet.
Right.
And then I have a sheet, the top sheet.
What about in the winter?
I add a... Sometimes I'll have another blanket at the foot of the bed, a throw. I have a throw that is currently in a chair in the family room, but I'll bring it in the winter.
Okay.
Because I like to save money and keep the heat off.
No, see, this is the thing. Growing up, I have it, but I rarely put it on because they all fly off. I get the loose sheet. What do you call that?
We'll call it the loose sheet. Whatever. The top sheet.
That top sheet. And then I have a kind of fuzzy sheet.
Okay.
It's always yellow.
Okay.
I have no clue. My mom always put it in the in our beds,
like,
and I have one
sheet.
It's like fleece. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it goes in between.
So top sheet, fleece sheet, comforter.
Comforter. And then I put either I put on the big old Mexican blanket I have.
Is that
very heavy?
Is that what it's branded as?
Oh, yeah. It's got, does mine have, mine has roses on it. Usually it's a lion. And then I have another sheet. I just have too many sheets. And it gets tiring. I don't want to make that every day.
That is a lot.
Forget it.
You know, my mother also has instilled this thing in me that I try and limit. I think she started the decorative pillow movement because there's more pillows, like the pillows now take up at her house. And growing up, they would take up half the bed. There's so many darn pillows.
See,
and all they do is throw them on the floor when they go to bed. It's too many pillows.
You never touch them.
The pillows are the most annoying thing about making the bed to me. No. Well, the fitted sheet, if it falls off, that's the most annoying thing. But then, like, why so many pillows? Why are we such a pro-pillow culture?
I don't. Well, I mean, because you don't even touch them.
No, you just throw them on the ground.
They are just for decoration. How dare you try to sleep on
them? How many pillows do you guys have in the bed?
Four.
Yeah, four.
Four, and then my boyfriend has a, I call it a crotch pillow, but he's
between
got it right in the legs.
Yep.
And I just go, get your stank pillow away from me.
So
he's like, this is just for my legs.
Is it one of the four,
sure,
or is it an additional pillow?
No, it's an additional.
See, I have four, but I take one of them and I use it as the so-called crotch pillow.
Right. No. I need height.
Yeah.
Height.
Curtis, do you use a crotch pillow?
I do not.
Okay. I was wondering if that was a guy thing.
I don't. That's because you're all rickety.
Sometimes I fold it in half. It's just to give everything a little bit more air breathing.
Really? Is that what it is?
I think so.
I thought it was for support of your body.
No. Esmeralda, think about what it's doing.
I know, but I was hoping for a better answer and not that, but all right.
Okay.
I have a neck sort of thing. Like if I sleep funny, my neck is stiff for a day.
Do you have do you have those cushiony pillows?
I do, yeah. But I will actually take two pillows and stack them on top of each other and sleep that way, so that way my head is propped up.
Like a double stuffed Oreo.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I do the same thing, but mine are on an angle.
Mm. Yeah, and that always helps me not have any like neck issues the next day.
If I do have two pillows behind me, if I've opted not to have the crotch pillow that night, what I like to do if I can't sleep is do like a switch. Like bring.
Do you use the crotch pillow?
Oh yeah,
on it's your all, head.
Oh. I mean, I'm wearing undergarments.
Doesn't matter.
But what I like to do, it's almost like a relief pitcher. If the first pillow ain't working for the first 2 hours of sleep, just switch them.
Wow.
And they're different consistencies or different textures.
You're able to do that in the middle of your day?
No, I'll wake up. I'll just wake up and go, nope, flop them out.
Do your pillows dance if you hit a home run?
Exactly, yes.
There's a song that
I call in the bull. Yeah, I call in the bullpen and they bring in the other pillow. Yeah. That helps me. That helps me fall asleep. It feels cooler. It's like the other side of the pillow sometimes just feels that nice coolness.
You got to get those pillows that don't get warm. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
But there's supposedly there's pillows that get cooler pillows. Or something.
What I like is that coming up next, we've got a really great guest to talk about really important things.
We're talking about pillows. Hey, you need the yin and the yang.
You sure do. 312-981-7200. Do you use a crotch pillow? Join the conversation, gentlemen. We'd like to hear from you.
It's not just men. I've seen people,
but body pillows is different, unless you are like giving your full leg up over it.
Which, that's what I've seen.
Yeah, if you're really giving it a cuddle. You could also find humans to do this with, but that's a lot
of
work.
They're too, those are warm.
Oh, well, then now I got a question for you. Do you cuddle through the night?
No, gross.
Okay. Do you do an initial cuddle and then a roll off?
Yes. Yeah, and then I go, get off of me. I'm going to sleep now, and I turn over.
Oh, you make it, you say it out loud. You verbalize this.
Well, one, yeah, because then they're breathing in your face. Are you kidding me? No, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I don't get the people that cuddle through the night. It's impossible. You get all sweaty.
Exactly. No. Yuck.
No. It's an initial cuddle, then it's a roll off.
Yeah, and then I have to turn.
Mm-hmm.
I can't face them.
I'm the same. Lately, I've been a turner, going the other way. It's the breathing. See everything. It's almost like you want to pretend like you got your own bed for a little bit of time.
Exactly.
312-981-7200. Still waiting for Roger to jump in on the chair there as we continue to talk about.
That's a lot of cough. Look at him. He's like, what do you mean? I got time.
Roger, you didn't hear us talking about pillow for 7 minutes?
He's got a
minute. We needed you, man. Where are you at? Jump in. What's wrong with Roger right now?
He's probably sleeping on the couch.
No, he's there now in the camera in the newsroom.
He's very confused. Look at him. Wow. Something clicked.
So what is happening in there?
You didn't know. Roger. This is God. Put on your headphones.
What the heck's happening, Roger?
What's going on?
I don't know. I was
sleeping.
We wanted your opinion on pillows.
Yeah, we had a whole crotch pillow conversation.
I'm so sorry.
We were like, the one thing we needed is Roger's opinion.
That's what they call them in college. I don't use a pillow. You don't use any pillow?
No.
Well, you're on the recliner, so.
Right. And before, when I was sleeping in the bed, two things, because I've got, that neck problem that comes and goes. So it was very hard for me to. I used to be a side sleeper for way too long, and the pillows were fine. I had no problems. But then when I had to switch to sleeping only on my back because of my neck problem, the angle of my head with the neck made finding an appropriate pillow impossible.
Yeah.
Just get rid of your neck.
Huh?
Problem solved.
Yeah, just
I could be. Who's the Sox player? No neck. What was his name? No neck Williams?
That sounds
Walter
right.
Walter No Neck Williams, I think, was the Sox player.
Yeah.
Seriously, he had very little.
I'm going to say yes.
Yeah. Thanks for being so agreeable.
I don't know.
Someone without a neck become a professional baseball player?
Yeah, because he had a very, very, that was his nickname. He had a very small sized neck.
Better neck than?
I don't know.
You should have asked him how he slept.
I never met him.
I'm sure there was some sort of interview where someone asked.
I'm sure there was.
Hey, well, no neck.
I've tried several different pillows. I tried a candy cane shape.
What?
Yeah, it's kind of like a candy cane.
Right.
So it's, if you sleep on your side, it supports, because this was after the surgery. I had trouble sleeping on my side, so this supported that side, and then it kind of helped support the neck in a weird way. Then I tried the kind that was like it was high on each side but low in the middle.
Okay, like a ravine,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah.
Where did you get all these pillows?
Yeah, Roger,
I bought them online and got rid of all of them within weeks of each other.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, this conversation's putting people to sleep. I'll tell you that much.
I'm sorry.
No, not your fault. No, it was probably the 8 minutes before that, too. We've got real important stuff to talk about after the news. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. It is 4:02. He's taking the candy cane pillow off and he's ready to deliver the news. Here's Roger. WGN, John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon filling in for the next hour up till 5 o'clock for Dave Plyer. Esmeralda, you feeling good?
Oh, of course.
Still rocking along. Here we go. You stayed up last, so you just stayed up through the night then after doing your live show.
Yeah. No point in trying to take a nap.
No. Mm-hmm. All right, so as we move on conversation-wise, we went from pillows, so I thought I'd transition.
Oh, there you go.
Our next guest is Katie Yeo. You're an amazing, inspirational person. Certainly. I've done a couple interviews with you now in the last few weeks, and I'm so excited to share your story and your organization's story with our WGN listeners. So you are a co-founder of ABLE, which stands for Artists Breaking Limits and Expectations, and you offer individuals with Down syndrome and other developmental differences the chances to collaborate on stage and movies, just to be artistic and express themselves. And it's an amazing organization. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you have a theater background yourself. Why don't you walk through how you got to this point where you started an organization that helps all these people out?
Yeah, I grew up performing. I grew up participating in a show choir and, theater programs in school and all of that. And I did my bachelor's at Syracuse University in drama. And at Syracuse, they have a program during my time. It was called the Young Actors Workshop. Now it's called All Star Cast, which was started by two faculty members there, Lizzie and Malcolm Ingram, who had a daughter with Down syndrome. And Becky was her name. And Becky had two actor parents and had no idea why she couldn't be an actor as well. So they started this program for her that pairs undergraduate actors with members from the community, the Syracuse community, with different developmental differences and intellectual disabilities and so on. And we would do shows every year. And I just loved it. I started to realize for me more exciting and fun and fulfilling than the rest of my college education. Mm-hmm. So fast forward a couple years to, doing the actor grind. And I still kind of held on to that feeling. And I had a really bad injury on a show that I was in.
Oh, gosh.
Which was kind of a soul-searching moment for me. And wound up going with a friend of mine to volunteer at Gigi's Playhouse Chicago, which serves individuals with Down syndrome and their families. And this friend Mallory and I just started this little weekly drama program that has snowballed into a nonprofit organization. Yeah. I never thought I'd be running.
And how does it manifest itself in plays and even recently some movies too?
Yeah, so we do generally with our teen ensembles, we do two plays a year. We'll do a classical play, something from the bigger canon like Shakespeare, or we've done Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, we've done Christmas Carol, and then we'll do a devised play where our actors kind of take the themes from the classical play and write their own stories and put their own spin on it. Mm-hmm. And then my co-founder and my husband, my partner in all things, Lawrence, has been taking some of those devised stories or some of the monologues and conversations that have come out of us creating those shows, and he has turned those into some screenplays. So we've done now two short, we did like a little series of short films and then two feature films based off of the imaginations of our ensemble.
I imagine a lot of the people that you work with, the students are, some of them probably already, maybe are already outgoing, and this is a really great opportunity for them to explore something that they want to do. But I imagine you've had also some kids and teens and young adults that you've seen transform from who they were. And the benefits are not just what happens on the stage or on the screen, but helps them in their everyday lives.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're a creative outlet and we're also a social outlet. And I think that that's a big piece of it. And when we got started at Gigi's Playhouse, there was a big conversation over when, like with the families we were working with, when they wanted programming to be. And the big thing they kept asking for was they wanted something on Friday nights, because we're working with teenagers and they're right at that point where when they're at school, most of the people in our program are in mainstream school. Mm-hmm. So they're hearing all the other kids at school talk about their weekend plans and what they're doing over the weekend. And so for our guys, it was important to have a place where they could say, you know, I've got a plan for Friday night too. I'm going to rehearsal. I'm going to be with my friends. So there's a huge social side as much as the creative side. And I think anybody who's done any sort of, and I know you've got a theater background, like it's cooperation and teamwork and social skills just as much as it's whatever artistic thing you're making.
What have some of the challenges been since you guys have started? Obviously, it's a difficult task in and of itself, and managing any teenagers or young adults into any performance, but obviously there's different challenges along the way with working with students with Down syndrome and other developmental differences, right?
Yeah, you know, hormones are real, and I think the thing with this population is just that the filter is not quite there. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily that they're feeling or experiencing something different than we may have been
at age 16
or whatever. It's just that they're going to go for it.
Right.
So there's a lot of sweaty, red face, crying.
Just like any, really, it is.
No, it's a lot. And we've got a lot of, you know, we'll do a lot of 1, 2, 3, and hands to yourself.
Right.
Like, let's end this hug.
Right.
Let's keep it professional.
Right.
We've got a lot of inter-ensemble relationships. So, you know, just working to keep everyone as professional and focused.
So it's basically indistinguishable from any group of teenagers.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, teenagers are figuring stuff out.
Yeah.
But we do have a responsibility to kind of teach them, I think, a little bit more so about acceptable boundaries and what's expected behavior and what's unexpected behavior, especially for individuals with intellectual disabilities in particular. The statistics around them being abused are staggering. They're
right.
7 times more likely to be abused. So we want to make sure they're kind of able to advocate for themselves and know, like, hey, this is cool and this is not cool.
Right.
Don't do that.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like? I mean, we talked about this when we did an interview for the public affairs show at WCIU, the idea that different actors bring different things to the table all the time. And, you know, like any other actor or actress, they bring something different to each character that they play. And it must be fun to watch them discover a new character, put a different spin on it, whether that's exactly what they intended. But, like, everyone's got a different perspective.
Oh, for sure. So what's cool about how we run a show at Able is that we try to give everyone a chance to be the lead. Mm-hmm. So we will start, if we're starting with the last show we did with Cyrano, so I'll use Cyrano as an example. We'll start the first, I'd say, 2 to 3 weeks of rehearsal just with characters and everybody learning all of the characters. So everybody has a chance to try on literally different hats and see what it is to be Cyrano or to be Christian or to be Roxanne or to be any of these different characters and start to think about what they relate to, what they like, how they want to embody them. And then they can, around midway through our rehearsal process, audition and tell us who they're the most drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
And our ensemble splits roles. So someone will play 2 or 3 different roles through the course of a show. And then you get to see all of the different sides of their personality. And you get to see 7 different interpretations of the same character and how each person can bring their own something to it, whether they're a really physical mover or they're a very verbal talker or they love to sing or whatever it is, they're able to embody that in their own way.
How long is the whole process from all these auditions to actually putting it out?
We'll take 10 weeks of rehearsal, so we'll have 10 90-minute rehearsals and then one longer dress rehearsal, about 2 hours, and then it's up. We do one big show. You get one chance.
Who are your good partners here in the city that have helped you guys put on shows?
We are incredibly blessed with our relationship with Chicago Shakespeare Theater. They've been just angels to us. Mm-hmm. We do field trips with them to go see their professional productions. They'll send actors to us to talk to us. Their education team's really helpful for us. And we've done now two shows with them. And then this December will be our third and fourth show, technically, at there. We partner a lot with Victory Gardens. I wish I could tell you our secret partner for our, we have a new program we just started this year, an ensemble for adults ages 22 and up, and our adults are working on a variety show.
And the adult angle is important because I think a lot of for some of these students, they are out of CPS at age 22, right?
22, yeah. No matter on what, your 22nd birthday, you are out the door.
Right, but there's a lot of young adults, obviously, that want to experience and still be creative. Absolutely. And play, and you guys give them a space to do that now with your adult levels too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's almost more important for the adults because we're getting more and more opportunities where, you know, colleges will have programming that is suitable for this population, or, you know, and a couple of our actors have gone off to these certificate programs at like National Lewis University, or I know Elmhurst has a great program. But there's not a whole lot out there. Mm-hmm. Like, the older you get, kind of the fewer and fewer the opportunities are. Mm-hmm. So we're finding it's more and more important that we have this adult program.
We're talking with Katie Yeo from ABLE Artists Breaking Limits and Expectations, which offers individuals with Down syndrome and other developmental differences the chance to collaborate on artistic projects. You guys wrote it so well, I just keep on reading it right off your website. It was very good. We're going to take a quick commercial break and have more coming up here on 720 WGN. Cool. 720 WGN, John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon filling in for another 36 minutes here until 5. Not that I'm counting down.
We have to count down. They just cut off the mics.
Yes, no matter. We better be done, otherwise we're done anyways. Talking with Katie Yeo from ABLE, which is Artists Breaking Limits and Expectations, and you guys do some great work with students, teenagers and young adults with Down syndrome and other developmental differences. And Katie, we've been just talking about how you found that was, when you did something similar in Syracuse, that was what you found the most enjoyment in. Why do you think that is? Is it because it's not just you're working with fellow actors and actresses and you're putting on this thing and it's gratifying for yourself, but maybe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the things that you guys do make a difference when these teenagers and young adults go home. And the parents must echo those sentiments.
Oh, yeah. I think you can see the impact a little bit more. I think it's, you know, for me, looking at, you know, working professionally and into the grind, it was like, why am I sending all these headshots out? And why am I schmoozing at this networking thing? And why am I doing this? Like, what difference is this making? And what is this for? Mm-hmm. And so to have something real concrete where you can say, like, oh, this individual did not have friends, and I've created a space where they feel safe and they've made friends, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, this individual was not speaking 6 months ago and now is speaking. Like, that's...
And we met on a public affairs show. I think you're referencing the student, and we met his mom too. And you could just hear from her. I mean, it makes her life better. It makes their family's life better because he found his voice.
Yeah, I think we're in a web. You know, it's not just about us and our relationship with our actors, but that's going to have a ripple effect to their relationships with their families. It's going to have a ripple effect to their relationships at school and to the rest of us as teaching artists and our volunteer facilitators. You know, it's impacting us as well and how we're able to better communicate with people, how we're able to interact with other individuals. And And I think it's feeding our creative selves and nurturing our creative selves in a very different way.
What can people look forward to? Obviously, October, you mentioned to me, that is Down Syndrome Awareness Month.
Down Syndrome Awareness Month in October.
So, knock, knock, that's tomorrow.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, October 1st is on Monday. So, what sorts of ways can people get involved with what you're doing?
We've got a couple different things going on. We are, we're very excited that our latest film, The Spy Who Knew Me, was an official selection for the Great Lakes International Film Festival. So, if you head over to their website, you can watch our movie online.
Oh, that's cool.
Until the end of this week. We're also a selection for the Awareness Festival, so a few of our ensemble members and Lawrence and myself are heading out to Los Angeles on Tuesday night to go attend a screening there.
Oh, that's
and do
wonderful.
Some panels. So if anyone's listening in L.A.
Yes. Hey. there they are.
Hello.
We had a call from Arizona just at the top of the show.
There you go. So L.A. Live on Wednesday night, Wednesday, October 3rd at 8 p.m. You can see The Spy Who Knew Me through the Awareness Festival. Here in Chicago, we're partnering with the Tortoise Supper Club on State Street through the entire month for their Cocktails for a Cause program. So they've looked at our mission statement. They've created a signature cocktail for us called the Curtain Call.
Oh, I like that.
And anytime you order the Curtain Call for the month of October, that money comes back to Able. So thank you, Tortoise Supper Club. And we're doing a happy hour night with them on October 23rd if you want to meet some of our adult ensemble members. And
one thing I wanted to mention that Lawrence brought up to me during one of the commercial breaks we were talking about earlier, your husband and partner in this project.
Partner in all things.
Yes.
That's what we call each other.
Was the idea that maybe if you know someone in a school system, if you're a teacher or you're at a business, who do you want screening these movies? Because you can actually have someone screen the movie in the classroom maybe. And not only why, tell us why someone should maybe want to do that.
Yeah, we have had, so we've screened for community centers. We've screened for group homes where people with varying disabilities live. We've screened for schools. We're screening with those who work with the special education program through the Chicago Park District. I think anybody can kind of watch our movies, and what we hope for our movies is to see what's cool about the worlds we've created is that we're not talking about disability at all. So we've got a cast of 20 actors with Down syndrome, but they all have fully functioning jobs and relationships, and they're out there in their world, and The Spy Who Knew Me, they're, you know, solving a bunch of diamond heists and missing persons, and there's lasers, there's all sorts of cool things.
Right.
But, you know, we're imagining a world where they can participate as fully as possible. And that's, I think, what everybody needs to be seeing. And seeing all of our actors through their entire, all of the spectrum of abilities that we have in our ensemble. So, you know, they're all playing to their strengths. So I think it's important to see how wide the rainbow of differences are and
right.
how many places we can make for them.
Yeah. In terms of volunteering,
have
you had anybody who comes in and they don't know much about anything, just kind of falling over themselves? Maybe they have all these stereotypes or things like that, or are people usually
we've had a lot of different our volunteers kind of fall into two packets. They're either actors who are a little disenchanted with acting, or they're coming from art therapy, special education, this kind of background. So we try to really support each other. I think we can all always do better.
Right.
You know, I can say that we can all always do better. The big thing we're saying right now at Able is we're trying to get out of the habit of referring to our actors as kids. Because we fall into that.
I've almost done it 10 times in this interview, and I got to remember, I said it's teens and adults.
I think to myself, God, when I was 16, if somebody called me a kid, I would be so furious.
Right.
And so trying to, you know, just we're all trying to do better.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the second that you're able to just look at this as a human, right? Like, this is a human, and I'm having a human to human interaction, and let's try to make that as honest and simple as we can. And then we go from there. But I think most of our volunteers all come in with
they kind of have a
beautiful
base
intention. Well, just come in with the best of intentions, you know? So then I think that's the thing. If you come in with an open heart and good intentions, I think we can deal with a lot of stuff.
The website is ableensemble.com. Mm-hmm. If someone's listening right now that might know someone, a teen or a young adult that has Down syndrome that wants to get involved in this project, do you guys have openings? How does that work? How can people get involved?
Yeah, well, the teen program right now, unfortunately, I hate to say this, has a wait list, mm-hmm. which just makes me sad because I wish we could take everyone all the time, always. The adult program, however, because it's brand spanking new, people can still register. So we're accepting registrations for the adult ensemble up till October 30th for this semester. And then we'll start another semester in January, February. But we also do outreach programming. So we'll go and do workshops with schools or community centers or other programs that maybe are serving this population. So we're totally happy to come in and lead a 1-hour workshop, 2-hour workshop, or we're doing a 6-week residency with National Lewis University. So we can set up stuff to come to you, even if you can't come to us.
And we want to create more seats, you know, to make, and obviously you guys are a nonprofit, you're doing your best. So if someone's listening and they just want to help out, how can they do that?
Well, visit our website. Of course, we keep all of our events up to date on there, and there's lots of information about different volunteer opportunities. Right now, we're hunting for a graphic designer.
Oh, okay.
Hello.
So don't look in this room. Keep hunting.
Lots of different volunteer opportunities. And of course, just come see our shows. That's kind of the most fun way to get involved. We've got shows coming up at Chicago Shakespeare Theater December 17th and 18th with our teen ensembles. Watch the website for our super secret location we can't reveal yet for the adult ensembles variety show.
Do you have a donation portal or no?
Absolutely. Okay, it's right there.
That's what I was trying to get you up. Let's have money.
On the website. Give me any money that you want to give me. Right there on the website, it's a big green button right on the top right-hand corner. You can't miss it.
Yeah, as we get towards the season where a lot of people start to give, what a great opportunity to give to someone. It's not one person's organization that does a lot of great stuff for a lot of people. Katie, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Esmeralda. Thank nice you. To see you.
AbleEnsemble.com. Good stuff. Okay, 4:31, which means we head up to the newsroom, and here's Roger Badish.
Ask not. The Beatles. Circuses on the air.
The president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like a...
That means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Jennings.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Ah! We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John's been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in 6 seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time. Win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, Dave Plyer out. But This Is History continues. Esmeralda Liana here as well. And a pleasant Sunday morning to Dave Schwann. How you doing, Dave?
Well, pleasant Sunday morning to you both. John, Esmeralda, how you
morning.
Doing?
Oh, it's good. We had a half-hour conversation about pillows earlier.
I heard.
It's a half hour?
I heard.
You heard, and you didn't turn us off. I appreciate that, Dave. Always good.
I did hear the pillow talk.
Do you make your...
look at that. Talk.
Do you make your bed every day, Dave?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, that's
no,
good.
No, I'll have to admit that. I do need new pillows, though.
All right.
Well, mine have seen better nights.
Ask Roger. He's got some.
He's got that candy cane pillow. I know. Yeah. You know how you know if you have a good pillow is you fold it in half.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes back, you're okay.
Okay. All right.
That's not going to happen with mine.
Do that test when you get home.
All right. So let's do This Is History. And we'll start in 1888. And National Geographic magazine published for the first time. And just to bring it to 2018, now I can't do the math, 130 years later, they have one of the best Instagram accounts you'll ever see. They've really obviously capitalized on the fact of how many photos they have, the videos, the great work they do. It's an amazing follow. I don't know, Schwann, if you're on Instagram, but that would be one reason alone to get on it because of the incredible photos they share.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. They are regarded as having some of the best photographers in the business, or some of the best in any publication. And I subscribe to National Geographic Traveler magazine.
Oh, okay.
And whoa. The pictures in that, some of them can be breathtaking.
I know my grandfather, who was a watercolor painter, artist, he had National Geo. I can remember, I can just picture the stacks in his basement, because he would travel the Southwest a lot and then replicate many of the different images and stuff.
Oh, how nice.
Oh, and he was a wonderful, wonderful watercolor artist. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was his profession. And so I know he used a lot of Nat Geo stuff to as inspiration for some of his paintings as well. Okay, Esmeralda, what you got?
1892, University of Chicago opens.
Okay. Happy birthday. Nice. That's good. That's a good school.
I didn't go there.
Have you ever been on the campus?
I have. It's like Hogwarts.
Yeah,
it's very pretty.
It is. They designed Hogwarts after the University of Chicago,
yeah,
I believe.
No, I would believe it.
All right, let's go to 1903. The first baseball World Series was played. The Pittsburgh Pirates and the Boston Pilgrims, who later became the Red Sox, of course.
Boston Pilgrims.
The Boston Pilgrims, which makes sense. Probably more sense than Red Sox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they should have kept that name.
Dave, I'm sure you know the answer. Who's won the most World Series in history?
Probably the New York Yankees.
Yes, I think it's 27 or 28 now. It might be.
Goodness.
Yeah.
And
do you know
far and away the most.
Do you know the second most? Comes out of the National League.
Oh.
Playing the Cubs this weekend.
St. Louis.
Yeah, St. Louis.
I was going to say either because St. Louis is one of the oldest in the National League with the Cubs, and then there's Cincinnati.
Yep.
So it would be, you know, St. Louis or Cincinnati.
Yeah,
St. Louis.
What's the 10th?
Yeah, St. Louis has 11. I don't know. 10th what?
I don't know.
Oh, 10th rank? I don't know. Cubbies, of course, have 3. The White Sox have 3. And I don't know. Hopefully the Cubbies can add a 4th one. The Cardinals have a lot to say about that before we get going. All right, Esmeralda, what you got?
1908, Henry Ford introduces the Model T Ford. It cost, this kind of sounds high to me, but $825.
It does seem like a lot, right? Because when you add inflation in.
That's a crazy amount of money for it, 1903.
Shawnee,
I'm sorry, 1908.
Shawnee, that was your first car. How'd it run?
Wow.
I'm still driving it.
I only said that because Roger's next to me. I had to get a crack.
You know what?
He got it from Roger.
That was a lot of money. That was a lot of money back then. One of the reasons, well, there were a number of reasons why Henry Ford did this, but Henry Ford paid his employees quite well for the time. One of the reasons why is because he thought if they're making these cars, they should be able to afford them.
Yeah,
so,
that's a
sound. Obviously, you couldn't, a typical worker then $800 was, as much money as he made in 6 months, maybe.
Oh, it's
more.
Incredible. Incredible.
And so, you save some of the money and then you could afford it.
Yeah.
But that he paid his employees quite well.
Right. And obviously reinvented the way not only cars are made, but the way modern industrial things are done.
The mass production of the cars and that sort of thing.
And
sure.
I would argue we don't win World War II without a lot of that stuff, because a lot of those plants were converted from.
They were converted from making cars to. Military gear. Yes.
Yep.
There's. I don't think there are any 1943 type model cars.
No, and very few 40. I mean, 41s obviously would be around, but
44, 45. Yeah. Very few. Yeah.
All right. So in 1927, sculpting began on the faces of Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills National Forest in South Dakota. It took a couple, obviously 12 years for some of the granite images to be revered and beloved, of course, of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and then Teddy Roosevelt took a little longer. I've seen video of the dedication of FDR sitting in the back of the car. He didn't stand up to make the speech then, so that would have been, what, 30 or 39 that he dedicated.
Have you ever seen pictures or film of the work in progress?
No, I haven't.
It's really amazing to see, because we've seen these images all our lives, or maybe you've been there. Have either one of you been there?
I have not been there.
Oh, you've got to go.
I've heard bad things.
What have you heard?
I've heard
what
that
do you mean?
I've heard that it's, it's a little out of the way from other things. And I'm just saying, telling you what you heard. I would probably go see it in a weekend if I had the time, but that it isn't as impressive as it maybe looks in photographs.
Wow. Sculptures on the side of a rock.
I'm just
of a mountain.
Telling you what I've
not
heard,
impressive.
People. I'm just telling you what I've heard.
Oof, what do these people need?
I can remember as a kid when we went to see it, we were driving up there, and it is a little out of the way. But
you have a magnificent drive to get there.
Okay.
You know.
I love a good drive.
And
so.
we were going through a wooded area, and all of a sudden we turned the corner. And there it was in the distance, you know, just as big as life. Yeah, I definitely think it's well worth seeing.
Yeah, I'll go do it, especially, you know, Chwani, how much I love presidents and the history.
That's right.
So, yeah.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Guy like you, yes, you need to go.
All right. Can you write a note to my work? I'll get a couple days off work.
Yeah, right.
All right, Esmeralda, what you got for us?
1950, the first comic strip of Charlie Brown called Little Folks. Later, Peanuts by Charles Schulz, published in only 9 papers. It wasn't until 65 that the first animated TV special debuted, A Charlie Brown Christmas.
Oh, that is my favorite one.
Is it?
I didn't know that was the first one, but that one's, I know we have a VHS copy at home that we had taped off of one of the broadcasts of it. And I love watching that, of course. Yeah. How many TV specials were there? I can't even... Did he do different holidays? I can't really picture.
There's a Halloween one, isn't
there? Oh, yeah,
pumpkin.
Where they're going around and everybody gets all this great candy and Charlie Brown gets, I got a rock.
Oh, poor Charlie.
Poor guy.
I got a rock. Everywhere they went.
1955, Captain Kangaroo premiered on CBS. Good morning, Captain. And Captain Kangaroo, not a show I've ever seen before.
I remember watching
a little bit
of it.
It's a little before my time.
He was still around, though, I think.
In the 80s?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure reruns.
Early 90s. I remember watching some of it. Beats me if it was, you know.
Was that a military rank for the captain, for the kangaroo? What was that?
That's a good question. I watched Captain Kangaroo. I would switch back and forth between him and Ray Rayner.
What did the kangaroo do?
That was just his name.
Cartoon,
it had nothing
right?
to do with a kangaroo.
Wasn't a kangaroo?
No. That was just kind of a, you know.
It was live action. It was a man.
Like a kangaroo coat.
He wore some sort of an officer's coat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't remember exactly what it is that he did. Yeah, he had and blonde hair with bangs.
It was not an early
Beatles
look.
Cut, is what it was.
Wait, you're telling me there's no kangaroos?
Was a farmer named Mr. Green Jeans,
and there was no kangaroos in this thing.
No,
nope. There was a puppet named Mr. Moose.
Yeah, in name only.
You think you'd have a kangaroo somewhere
right.
in the show?
In name only, Kangaroo Court.
Sounds good. All right. Okay.
All right. In 1955, movie star James Dean dies at the age of 24 in a car crash on a California highway. Dean was driving his Porsche 550 Spyder that he nicknamed Little Bastard, headed to a car race in Salinas, California. All of that sounds terrible.
Yeah, no.
I'm amazed that, what happened.
He was with this mechanic and didn't go very well.
Yeah, they were involved in a head-on collision. That was with a car driven by a 23-year-old college student. Dean was taken to Paso Robles War Memorial Hospital, and there he was pronounced dead at 5:59 p.m.
Man, he became such an icon for someone who was only 24 years old at the time he died. Obviously, he represented a lot during that era.
I often think that had he lived, he would have been just astounding. I mean, to watch his work even to this day in Rebel Without a Cause or East of Eden, Giant. Just an incredible talent.
Yeah.
Also, he was on Broadway for a while.
Yeah,
too.
I guess so. He did Broadway stuff.
Interesting.
Because he worked. He studied at the Actors Studio.
New
York.
Yeah, that's too bad. 1968. Rod Serling's Twilight Zone premieres on CBS, and we actually have a conversation that Dave had some years back with Serling's daughter Anne about the beginnings of Twilight Zone.
Yeah, so CBS purchased a teleplay in 1958, so this is a little bit before The Twilight Zone began. It's something your father wrote and hoped to produce as a pilot of a weekly series. It was called The Time Element. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, The Time Element was bought by CBS, and CBS shelved it for a year. And then it was bought by, I think his name was Bert Gannett, who worked for Desilu Studios, and... because Bert was looking for good shows, and he wanted one of my dad's, and so they aired The Time Element, and I guess at the time it received more mail than any other show that Desilu Productions had aired that year.
That's interesting stuff. And Dave, I don't know if it was you. Were you talking about Twilight Zone recently on WGN? I was driving around. Maybe it was last Sunday. Oh, yeah. Was that you talking about it?
Yeah, it was a week
with
ago.
Pete, when, maybe?
With Pete McMurray, who was in for Dean. Yes.
Talking about all the airplane episodes they've had on Twilight Zone.
Terror at 20,000 Feet is one of the classics, a young William Shatner.
Oh, with the gremlin on the side
of the gremlin on the side of the wing. The reason that came up was we were talking about the new show called Manifest.
Oh, right.
Where the people land and they've been missing for 5 years.
That debuted last week. Did you watch it? What'd you think?
You know what I did? I TiVo'd it.
Oh.
I haven't watched it yet, but I've saved it, so I'm going to watch it.
Interesting.
I saved a couple of things I wanted to see for the new season, but yeah, I'm definitely interested in something like that. I just think that show may have gotten influenced by that one, and there's another Twilight Zone where the pilot is trying to land, and he keeps going back into time.
Oh, interesting. So there's no more runway.
There's no runway. They go back into prehistoric times.
Oh, gosh. Dinosaurs
then,
all over the place.
Yeah, then he's over New York. He says, okay, we made it. And he's making radio contact and using terminology that the air traffic controller is not familiar with. So he can't land.
Oh.
He's so close, but he can't land.
So what do they do? Spoiler alert.
They just keep going.
Okay.
And you figure it out for yourself.
How much gas is on this plane?
That's another thing. They were running low on fuel.
I hope so.
Yeah. So all kinds of stuff, but you know, they go one thing to the next, and you decide for yourself. You, the viewer, decide what happened at the
interesting.
End of it.
Well, on to the next. 1967, Thurgood Marshall sworn in as first black Supreme Court justice.
And what's crazy is I think that there's only been two, because Clarence Thomas, who's currently on the court, is the second. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but I don't think there's been another African American.
They are the only two. Yes,
that's. Yes. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Thurgood Marshall also represented the NAACP during a lot of the civil rights things in the 1950s. And then Lyndon Johnson appointed Thurgood Marshall as the first African-American Supreme Court justice.
Did he ever make it to Supreme Court? No, I think he stayed as an associate the entire time. I don't know if he ever led the court.
No, he was never chief justice.
Never led the court.
No.
And obviously Sandra Day O'Connor, first female.
Correct.
And that was Reagan, a nominee. Because he actually made the promise during his campaign that he would nominate a female to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And now we, of course, have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, of course. 1968, the cult zombie film Night of the Living Dead, directed by Romero, premieres. What a great movie that is.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
That's good stuff.
All right. And now, funny, I love them. 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus premieres.
Oh, good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the movie in the theater when it came out.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I wanted to skip, actually, to 1985 because we're running a little bit out of time here. But 1985, actor Rock Hudson, who was 59, became the first major celebrity to die of complications from AIDS. And his death really raised public awareness of the epidemic, which until that time had been ignored by many in the mainstream as a gay plague. Do we have a clip on that, Curtis? Go ahead and play that.
Rock Hudson was once asked if he had any regrets about his career as an actor. You bet, he replied. I regret Son of Cochise and The Desert Hawk and all those other dumb pictures. His career certainly had some high points. Here's ABC's Judd Rose.
He was tall, dark, and handsome, and he had that name. If Rock Hudson had never existed, Hollywood would have invented him. And in a way, Hollywood did. But then he was a star.
Yeah, so it's obviously Rock Hudson was a major star. And I actually did I was doing some reading on the AIDS crisis in America. You know, it's so, you know, I was born in 84 and I'm gay. I came out, obviously knew what AIDS was. And I, you know, in the 2000s, but it's still HIV is still obviously very prevalent in our society and something to be talked about. But like people like Rock Hudson and others that died of it that you wouldn't expect or that really shocked people really did pave the way for a better understanding of what the disease was. And it made it something to at least something we could talk about, direct funding towards. So, obviously a horrific incident. Obviously it helped a lot of people later on to eventually deal with that terrible
disease.
Well,
to talk about it.
To talk.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was not just confined to the gay community.
Exactly. And I was listening to some clips from Reagan's deputy press secretary about AIDS and chuckling in the press rooms when people would talk about it, when there was questions from reporters, brief questions. The one thing the Washington Post put together a really interesting timeline. And I'm not trying to judge the Reagan. I mean, Well, I will judge the Reagan administration on some things they do. I don't want to go into it because it would be, we don't have enough time for it. But at least
they tried to sweep it under the rug.
Well, good. At least you can say I didn't want
that was the case. Yep. Then they were kind of forced into talking about it.
Yes, exactly.
And the fact that this is something that we need to deal with.
It's definitely something that clouds his overall ranking in my mind as president. We won't get into that, though.
No. We'll talk about that dark triad later.
We still have to do our president podcast.
I was just thinking about it, Shawnee. We got to do it. We got to go by one. Why don't you end with a good one here?
And I think so.
Yeah.
2006, WikiLeaks is launched.
Good, bad. Again, at least, I don't know. I don't know where to end on that one.
That opened quite a Pandora's box.
Was there already Wikipedia
bad.
At that time? I think there was.
Yeah, I bet so. Yeah. I think it had it early on in its infancy. Hey, guys, we got to take a quick commercial break. We got Walter Jacobson's perspective coming up here on 720 WGN.